People are getting settled, a few of them, but let's get started. I'm Chris Sharon. I am honored to serve on the board here at Holden, so I'm here leading up to the board meetings, which start for some of us on Wednesday and for the whole board on Friday. But along the way, also, I'm teaching a couple of sessions this week and a couple next week. I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And this particular topic, the church's debates about sexuality, has been a reluctant focus of mine for quite a while. Reluctant, I would say, because it's come out of, for me, as a way to start, it's come out, for me, out of frustration and sometimes even anger at the church's struggle to welcome people that I know and love, to welcome them, to honor their calls to ministry, especially gay and lesbian brothers and sisters who I've met in seminary and so forth. And so I feel like this work that I've done on the Lutheran Church's struggles to deal with issues of sexuality and especially homosexuality have been, for me, a calling because I'm a man, because I'm straight and married, because I can go through the church's candidacy process with no challenges at all to my call to ministry, with affirmation all along. A call for me to use my relative safety to engage these questions and to say things that I think and that others think, and to try and foster conversation, because one of the dramatic elements in our whole church's experience over the years that we've been talking about these issues has been the opportunity for conversation one with another. And the first summer that I came to Holden was 1996, and I helped lead a forum that summer with Ingrid Chris Johnson, How Our Hearts Have Changed. And the panel that night was two gay men, one on teaching staff, one the fire chief, and a mother of a gay son. And in that conversation, they started, come on in, find a seat. The front row is good because you can put your feet up on the fireplace. In that conversation, we had the opportunity to hear one young gay man talk about growing up in the church with self-loathing, feeling like God hated him, the church hated him, that he was unacceptable, and contemplating suicide, and Holden Village being the very first place that anyone ever said to him that it was possible. He was beloved by God and not hated. So I've been motivated, and I would say, come on in, find a seat. There's chairs over here too. Motivated to try and foster conversation, and that's what I want to do tonight. Not so much to tell you what's in the social statement. You can read that if you want, but to foster some conversation about what's distinctive about it, why it matters, and what work it does for our sake in the Lutheran Church, and I would say beyond the Lutheran Church. So the first thing I want to do, how many of you have read the whole thing? The whole 30 pages? I think 30 pages. Maybe half dozen of you? The first thing I want to do is just briefly sketch the shape of it, so you have a sense of the shape of what's been done, starting with where it came from, just very briefly, and then what the task force has done in terms of a skeletal structure for the social statement. The ELCA began in the late 80s, and this issue came up pretty much right away because at my seminary, Pacific Lutheran in Berkeley, three senior seminarians decided as a part of their approval process and assignment process as senior seminarians to come out, to publicly say that they were gay. And at that time, it created a really big reaction in the church. Bishops all convened in Berkeley to try and figure out what to do about this crisis, and all sorts of things unfolded from that. One thing that unfolded from that was the construction of a document, a couple of documents to guide candidacy, one vision and expectations, and the other guidelines for discipline, both of which embody the Lutheran Church's current policy that people who in their self-understanding are homosexual, if they're called to ministry, have to, quote, refrain from homosexual practice. I have gay friends who say, why does the church think we need to practice so much? But anyway, that's the awkward language that we've adopted. And the other major thing that came out of that time period, in addition to those what I would call juridical documents, documents that guide the structure of our call process and our life in terms of rostering people for ministry, is a desire for a social statement on human sexuality. The Lutheran Church in America developed a social statement on sexuality called Sex, Marriage, and the Family in the 1970s, and it took them almost the whole decade of the 1960s in debate after debate, gathering after gathering, to finally arrive at a statement. The ALC also did a social statement that they developed in the 70s, and it was finally approved in the early 80s, called, I don't know, it was more prosaic than that, something about human sexuality or human sexual behavior. I think it had behavior in the title. So we had, as a part of the ELCA's history, some documents, but the ELCA wanted, people wanted the ELCA to come up with a fresh statement of these issues. So Karen Bloomquist, who was head of the studies department for the ELCA, led work on a social statement in the early 90s. And I won't rehearse that whole history, but basically that's that whole time since the early 90s, the ELCA has been working toward a comprehensive social statement on human sexuality. And driving it all along has been this question of, shall we say something different than what the predecessor bodies said about homosexuality? That at its root, it's a disordered state. It's a defective state, a result of sin, and therefore it's not blessable in terms of its working out in sexual relationships. Gay marriage or gay unions aren't acceptable, and people who are called to ministry have to be celibate if they're in their self-understanding they're homosexual. And many of you, in many different ways, I'm sure, have participated in those conversations. And that question certainly has continued to play a central role in the conversations since this particular task force convened in about eight or so years ago. There's lots of other things that are dealt with in this social statement. A full range of issues that relate to human sexuality. So it's driven by a particular concern, but many important issues are dealt with in the statement. It starts with, I'm not going to say in detail what it says, but just to give a sense of where it goes, it starts with a framework that describes Lutheran theology. How do we believe God interacts with the world, with creation, and with us in particular? And how does that theological understanding give us a framework for working on questions of sexual ethics today? And that's what, in 2001, was asked of the churchwide assembly, that they would vote to convene a task force who would give us a social statement with a fundamental theological framework for understanding these knotty questions that face us around sexuality. It roots this understanding in an idea about trust, God's trustworthiness, and our effort to imitate that trustworthiness in our human relationships with one another. Relationships of all sorts, not just sexual relationships. And they talk about social structures that help to foster that trust. So marriage would be an example of a social structure. You might call it a social institution. A family in general would be an example of what they're talking about, social structures. They're basically holding places for hopefully generative, safe development of human persons in their fullness. And so those spaces, those social structures, are places where we hope for the development of trust. Then they talk about the importance of trust in human relationships, from just the ordinary kinds of family relationships and friendships to all kinds of other sorts of relationships, all the way to, they talk about same-sex relationships, marriage, sexual relationships between people who are heterosexual but not married. Then they talk about social responsibility, the big sort of social questions that we face, including sexual abuse, prostitution, pornography, all the kinds of the media's exploitation of sex and advertising, all those kinds of social questions which relate to sexuality, abortion and birth control, you know, you can imagine the whole range. And then they conclude by saying, geez, what a mess, you know, this whole area of sexuality. We just have to be merciful with one another because none of us have it figured out. And so we live together begging for forgiveness, God's and each other's. It's a really great ending, I think. And then implementing resolutions, basically. Social statements in the ELCA have official status in this way. They're commended to congregations and to individuals for the sake of study. So there are ways of that the church has to encourage its membership around specific issues. We have one on education, for instance, or on peacemaking. And so if this were to be passed, it would have that status as a way that we as a church say to our membership and to the broader society, here's, we think, a deep and valuable root for thinking through these questions. It also plays a social policy role for the ELCA. So the ELCA, if this is passed by the Churchwide Assembly in August, then follows this as its own policy. So for instance, in its public policy advocacy in Washington, it would advocate for policies that embodied commitments in the social statement. Or, as we'll talk about tomorrow, in the case of our own rules within the ELCA, it would have certain implications for what we do in terms of gay and lesbian people, their commitments one to another, their sense of call to ministry, and so forth. So that's the ways that it functioned. The resolutions sort of spell that out. Here's the ways we, as the writers of this document, can see the consequences unfolding as a result of what we've said in this statement. Well, what I want to do just to start is, this is a whiteboard where I want to just do some sort of silent brainstorming. And those of you who want to, there's two pens, and don't write real big because it will take up a lot of space, but write medium so people can read it, hopefully. And what I want you to do is just come up to the board and write your thoughts about this general question. What? The ELCA finally has a social statement on sexuality? I want you to just, that fact that we're now ready to vote on a social statement on human sexuality, I want to ask you the question, so, you know, how does that matter to you? What do you think when you hear that we're voting on a social statement on human sexuality? Just come up, hold silence for a few minutes while people do this, and just come up and write your thoughts, reactions to that question as a way for us to sort of pool reactions as we get started. So we'll take a few minutes and let you do that. I'll turn Charlie Hayden back on just for meditation. Thank you. Josh, you can start. Break the ice.
I'm a seminarian.
Anybody who wants to, just go write a word, a phrase, a sentence. What does it matter that now we're to the point where we have a social statement on human sexuality and we're voting on it in churchwide assembly? There's no right answers, just whatever your gut feeling is, your gut reaction. Just write the words down. I'll be a proxy for anybody up on the balcony if you want me to write something down for you. So, just a scattershot of reactions and thoughts people had as we contemplate coming to this point in our journey as a church. Some of the responses up here: why do we have to vote on how we're created? What will it change? Further discussion is good, but is this truly a statement? We're moving too slow. Hopeful but nervous. Movement up on the top here. Show respect for all. We're called to be inclusive. Will there be pictures? We are called to love one another. I'm sure there'll be pictures, but they'll be airbrushed. Did anyone see that cover of the Lutheran that had a picture of the baby Jesus naked on it a couple of years ago, and it had a certain section of the baby Jesus airbrushed in order to be more palatable to the Lutherans audience. That's actually heresy. Jesus was fully human. Well, these are a set of comments that say to me, among other things, impatience. I mean, the fact that we've been working toward this social statement since the early 90s doesn't surprise me to have that response. Well, I'm going to take this hopeful but nervous comment and say a few things about why we might be hopeful if we're, in a sense, hoping for change in what we've been up to on these issues. What's different about this social statement, if you're reading through it, that might give you reason to hope? And after I just have three or four things, and I'll basically frame them quickly, and then see if there's responses or comments about that particular aspect of the document. And if you read it through, after we have these couple of points as a part of our thinking and our conversation, I think you'll be able to see them. The first one is starting with new creation. This is from Nadia Boltz-Weber's new church in Denver. And they took the Christmas circulars, all the ads, and cut and pasted them and made a Madonna and Child as an Advent activity, taking the sort of redeeming the commercialism in a way. But I put up the image of Mary and Jesus as a way to say the statement doesn't start, as many of our statements about sexuality have, with the original creation, with what apparently Adam and Eve were up to in the garden before sin. And that beginning place matters profoundly in the unfolding of the statement. Now, when you start reading the statement, it doesn't start with comments about new creation, but it starts with Jesus, and with Jesus' primary command to us to love God with heart and soul and mind, and to love one another as we love ourselves. That summary of all the law and the prophets is their starting place. So it's a choice to start with Jesus and with the new creation his life and death and resurrection offers, not just to us as Christians, but to the whole creation. So that starting place matters. Why does it matter? What do you think? Why would it matter for a social statement on sexuality to start with new creation instead of with our imagination about the original creation? Yeah, Joan.
Well, some of my thinking goes along the lines. The new creation means, well, it's we start again. And I work in a public library, and I run a computer lab. So I see a lot of sex, and I see people dealing with sexual issues. And we need to wipe it out, because people view sex as bad. We need to see our bodies as good. We need a new creation. And whether that you are Christian or whether you're gay or heterosexual, many, many people view sex as a bad, negative thing. And we need to create a new church that views our bodies as holy and sex as good and positive. And so that's my view on the new creation.
Yeah, great. That's great. The Christian church, Charles Taylor has invented a word to describe what the Christian church has done over its history in the West, which is excarnation. He thinks we've actually taken an incarnational faith and reversed it, hated the body. And he's a philosopher and a person who's writing in really profound and helpful ways about the life of faith today. And that's one place where he really sees this powerful opportunity And I think this social statement tries to get at that. It tries to recover the beauty of the body and the importance and value of the body as God's good handiwork, and sexuality as a full part of that. So, good. Anybody else? Why would it matter to see on the back over here?
Well,
Dick.
For me, it sees creation not as sort of a static thing that has a static beginning, and it's an ongoing kind of process. It has a beginning, and all kinds of new things happen.
Great.
We have from the beginning.
Great. One of the really profound themes throughout this social statement is that we're not living in a world that was created by a watchmaker God, set forever, and we're just puppets, sort of living out our lives in that set forever world. There's ongoing living creation in which we're participants. Martin Luther talks about our lives being channels through which God works this creative work. So you could think about the artist's hands, my son's hands playing guitar, you know, as this continuing creation. Luther talks about a woman's breastfeeding her child as an example of God's continuing creation. So that's a really important consequence. And it means something profound in terms of then what we would say about our learning about the nature of our bodies and our lives as sexual creatures, that we may come to a conclusion that's not the historic conclusion about sexuality and about relationships because of this ongoing living creation. Yeah, good. Anybody else on this one?
I think when you begin with the creation story of Adam and Eve, you begin with trickery and temptation and judgment. If you talk about new creation in terms of Christ, you begin with forgiveness and grace and reconciliation.
Yeah. There's a different kind of story that's going on there. And it's not so much that one is lost. It's simply a matter of where you start. Because the creation story is still present, partly to tell that story of brokenness. Where did this brokenness come from? Well, here's a story that helps us know where the temptation to, as Fred said in Bible study, to always be right. You know, where did that come from? But we don't start there. Here's a lovely quote that they use from Dietrich Bonhoeffer about another reason why we don't start with the original creation. Bonhoeffer says, "The attempt, with the origin and nature of humankind in mind, to take a gigantic leap back into the world of the lost beginning, to seek to know for ourselves what humankind was like in its original state, and to identify our own ideal of humanity with what God actually created, is hopeless. It fails to recognize that it is only from Christ that we can know about the original nature of humankind. Only in the middle, as those who live from Christ, do we know about the beginning." And you all know how stories about the beginning are used. I was just at the Montana Synod Assembly, and I heard someone give a speech about God creating Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And Fred talked this morning about the relationship between Adam and Adama, the soil and the earth and the earth creature. And so we take those origin stories and we use them very often in ways that look a lot like our idealized now, projected back into the original creation. Sometimes Lutherans have talked about social structures, as this statement refers to them, as orders of creation, and used those as if they were static ways of organizing social institutions, and then use them in such a way to enshrine certain contemporary cultural values. It was used in Nazi Germany to say that it was forever ordained that the political the government would have its own authority from God and the church separate authority, and so we were to just obey God's authority given to the government and led to terrible consequences, as we all know. It was used in the 1950s in the United States as a way to say, after World War II, women should go back home and not work for gender equality, not seek ordination, not work outside the home. And then in the 70s and 80s and 90s, used as a way to say homosexuality wasn't part of God's original creation. So a whole set of consequences that we've exegeted together come from this starting point of a social statement. Here's another really important focus in the social statement. This is a billboard that was put up by a law firm in Chicago a couple of years ago. And it symbolizes a reality in our society that the social statement is trying to respond to. A kind of crassness in our culture about the value of trustworthiness, of fidelity, of promises. This sort of disposability of our commitments and of promises, depending on what we feel like at the moment. Oh, that looks good. I want that now. You know? I ordered Rocky Road, but actually that guy's Death by Chocolate looks better, so I'm going to go over and, you know, take that. It's funny with ice cream, but it's not funny when it's human lives. And this was an utterly serious ad campaign, and they specialize in divorce law. And one of the central starting places in this social statement is to focus on the theological value, trust, that at the heart of our relationship to God is a relationship of trust. God's trustworthiness and God's promise to us, God's promise of love and of presence, and God's call to us to trust in God instead of trusting many other things for our well-being, and to enter into relationships of promise giving and trust with one another. Why would that matter as an important theme in a statement on human sexuality? Where could you see that going? Not just in relationship to homosexuality, but you can take it there too if you want. This theme is, I'm raising it up partly because it hasn't ever been a theme in social statements that we've done as a church on sexuality. So it's in a sense an old theme, a central theme, but not a theme that's been lifted up in the central way that it is in this statement. So where does your mind go thinking about that theme of trust and betrayal?
I think in our culture we tend not to trust people we disagree with, whether it be politically, theologically, or whatever. And so we can't get to a point where we can trust one another if we disagree with one another.
Yeah. And that, you would relate to what? What value is behind that, that leads to that?
We were talking about this morning, we want to be right, and we can't trust someone that's not right.
Yeah. Where else does this go for you, thinking about trust?
Seems to me trust and betrayal are, the concept themselves are genderless.
Yeah. Their primary orientation is not gendered, it's human. Yeah, that's helpful. What else do people think when they think about this value of trust as a feature of our lives, one with another?
I think it's downplayed a lot in our society. There's not as much focus on it in certain realms as there should be. Just like with the bodies right here, that showing these parts of the bodies or the divorce is really downplayed. It's really kind of brought to a level where you were talking about it's nothing, where there should be more importance on the fact that his chest and her breasts are on this huge billboard, as with the trust and betrayal are big, they're big things in life, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really telling that it's just the torso. There's no face. They're in a sense anonymous. They could be anybody. Something regularly featured in social statements that we've constructed before has been an argument about biology, complementarity. I laugh because I worked summers as a plumber, and if you have ever worked, anybody worked as a plumber? There's male parts and female parts. And social statements talked about God's intention for sexuality as if it was really centered on plumbing parts. And the plumbing parts only fitted together one way for one purpose. So the way of talking about sexuality and relationships related to sexuality was focused on biology. And so then a particular kind of reading of the scriptural texts related to creation, for instance, were seen to be basically encouraging and framing that kind of complementarity. And what the trust does is it reframes that from biology to relationships, to human relationships, and not about which parts fit together, but about the character of our concern and love with one another. And so there, you can see the way that this takes a different shape for talking about what's at stake, what's at the heart of our concern in sexuality. One of the funny things, Kathleen may have some. Are there any Catholics other than Kathleen here? Couple. Kathleen's sister. There are arguments about the relationship between God and the church that sort of work on the plumbing model too. So you can work it in the God-human relationship out of that biological model, but it just strikes me as hilarious and goofy to do that, to sort of create God as this sexual being who relates to the church or to humanity in that sort of way. And I think this focus on trust, on relationality, offers a way to take the heart of what we understand to be the God-human relationship and have that be how we talk about human relationships too. The question of trust and fidelity, of covenant, just go right through the heart of Scripture. And one of the fascinating proposals in this social statement is a kind of proportionality proposal about sexuality, that the level of intimacy ought to parallel the level of commitment. So they don't say in some kind of black and white way, you should have no intimacy before you get married, and then after you're married, you can do anything you want. It's not that kind of black and white world. They offer a kind of reasonable, I think, thoughtful model for thinking about sexual relationships across a continuum of relationships, from a very casual friendship, someone you haven't seen for a long time, and you give them a hug, and they say, wow, you know, that's in the broad sense related to sexuality. It's our bodies, it's skin, you know, it's our emotions and our heart engaged in that relationship. And that all the way to the fullest kind of sexual intimacy that you can imagine. And they propose that for a relationship to have the space to hold the building of trust, the building of love and safety, this kind of parallel between levels of commitment and levels of intimacy, they say, ought to be what the church teaches and supports. And the social structures fit into that. We have institutions like marriage for the sake of creating a space in which that commitment, that level of commitment, can be publicly acknowledged and blessed and supported as a context in which that intimacy can be expressed. So, the third of four points that I think are fresh and important in this social statement is that they make the claim that sexuality is not an issue of salvation. That our salvation, the new life that we receive in Christ, is not at stake in our debates about who we ought to have a relationship with. That, in a sense, these kinds of relationships are worldly things, things that are a part of our life. And it's an interesting question we could talk about probably another time, because it opens up a whole bunch of questions not related to the social statement itself. But it makes this proposal, and it does some particular work for the social statement to say these questions, in a sense, aren't a question, don't raise the question of whether our very salvation, our very core understanding of the faith is at stake. We can all agree, in a sense, they're saying, about how we're saved. We're saved by Christ through faith, and that's common. And then, in our life together, as Christians, we work out these questions of how we vote, how we marry, how we do all kinds of, in a sense, worldly things. They're not trying to say it doesn't matter. They're just trying to separate two different kinds of matters in the life of the church. There's a whole argument being made now, and it's been made over many years, that these questions are a central matter of salvation, and that in saying the church ought to change its convictions on sexuality is tantamount to saying we believe in a different God. And so this isn't a simple claim, it's a contested claim, but it's a claim that the social statement makes. So what do you think about that?
I actually think it's something that conservatives and progressives within ELCA can agree on. I think there's a sense that people that are conservative are kind of on the most extreme side of the issue, you know, like picketing, and you know, there are people like that, and there are people like that within the church, but it's not the majority. I think most Lutherans would agree that sexuality is not an issue of salvation. I hope.
Do you think that the people who are presently being excluded would buy into that statement? Do you think that they believe that the church is saying to them that this is not an issue of salvation?
I don't know. My guess is you might get a variety of answers. I personally find it very difficult to accept the church's claim that all are welcome, that all are, in a sense, redeemed. But some people still are enduringly defective, or whatever term you want to choose that's traditionally been used, as a category of people, you know. So I personally feel like there's something tied up in that we haven't unknotted as a whole church that needs to be unknotted. That actually the claim about salvation isn't a sort of partial gift to some. Someone over here had something.
Say, you know, instead of sexuality, say sin is not an issue of salvation. For those who say homosexuality, all kinds of sexual acts are sins, It's still not an issue of salvation. Grace is the issue of salvation. Mm-hmm. Any more than gluttony or gossip or... None of this is about salvation. It's about Christ's love for one and our love for one. I don't know.
My concern is that this gets people off the hook of changing the way that we relate to one another here and now in this life, and that, you know, you might live hell on earth, but you will be saved. And that's gonna be great.
I think along with that, we focus on when we think about salvation, we tend to think about individual salvation mm-hmm. instead of the community. Mm-hmm. And if you're thinking about the community, then it can be an issue of salvation. I mean, I would agree with that individually, yeah. But community, it's a much bigger issue.
Larry?
To the extent that almost anything can become a form of idolatry, idolatry is an issue of salvation.
Yeah.
In my experience, most people I hear from, sexuality is not an issue of salvation for them, but sexuality would be an issue of leadership. Mm-hmm. Who they picture or could embrace as their leader. Mm-hmm. And this is what I find people have the most difficulty with. They don't think they question a person's sexual practice as being outside the grace of God, regardless of what it is. It's who or how, what they can accept as leadership. And going back to that idea, is it whether it's homosexuality or another kind of sexual practice of being, if it's considered sinful, if it's open, and if that leader is openly misrepresenting a life lifestyle. This is where I hear people have the most difficulty, not the issue of salvation itself.
Right. And that goes back to the question of welcome in Christ, and there's a number of people who do not wish the church to change its position on homosexuality who argue very strongly that they fully welcome gay and lesbian people in Christ as their brothers and sisters in the church, and as a part of their Christian life, they feel compelled to encourage them to a life of celibacy because they believe homosexuality to be sinful. And so that kind of perspective leads to the worry that you're describing, this worry about what it means to be a called leader of a Christian community. And so I think what they're trying to do here in distinguishing issues that would cause us to, in a sense, not be able to go to walk with you in your difference of opinion. They would bring up the issue of in World War II and the church's claim that what was happening, and this refers to what Larry was mentioning, I don't know if he had this in mind, but the Confessing Church in Germany believed that what was at stake was idolatry, was setting up another god, and they were being asked to basically worship another god. And so their rejection of that, they're saying, no, this is an issue of our salvation, was because the temptation, the invitation was to say, supporting the state, the government at that time, was betraying their salvation. And what this social statement is saying is that we share a common understanding of who God is and what salvation means for us. And so, but yet, in terms of our understanding of this question of how we live out our lives as sexual creatures, we don't all agree on that. But we can bear with one another in the midst of that disagreement, because it's not a central question of whether we're worshiping the wrong God. So in the way, let me go to the next slide and just make the connection here. What they do with this is they use this as an argument to lead them into something like what St. Paul argues for in the struggles between people who felt in their freedom in Christ they could eat meat that was sacrificed to the idols, and others who worried that that would be idolatry, that they would be tainted by that. And Paul saying, well, you know, in Christ doesn't really matter, but I encourage you to bear with your brothers and not do anything that would cause them to sin. So there's a kind of parallel here where they're saying, you know, people in good faith, believing that they've read the scriptures well and they've attended to our confessional interpretation of the scriptures, end up in different places. And we can remain one church together, walking together, talking together, struggling over these issues together, while claiming one faith, one baptism, one Lord. And the reason I think the social statement works hard to make that case is because of what I view to be a lot of circulating sort of hushed concern about what's going to happen. How many congregations are going to leave? What kind of divisiveness will this cause? Well, I think it's an argument that has integrity and that tries to reach out broadly in the church and say, we're not at a point where we want to just say everyone who disagrees with this one position is out. You know, you're no longer, your voice and your view are no longer acceptable. They're not faithful positions. So I think they're trying to make room in a big and very diverse church. They're trying to make room for us to understand this issue in such a way that we can continue to walk together and struggle with this issue together, even as we move forward, by making space officially for congregations and the church as a whole to say, listen, people are already living, in a sense, married in the sight of God, same-sex couples, and many are serving the church. And we want to have an opportunity for those places who are able to bless and encourage that and to call them in ministry. And do that with the sense in mind that there are others who aren't able to do that. I think I was too young to remember it, but I think a similar kind of gradual transition happened around the ordination of women. It wasn't everybody who was on board. I don't know what the vote was, but it wasn't 100% vote. I think it was actually very close. And so I think that's sort of where we are with this two-sided coin, with the issue not being an issue of salvation and therefore allowing for the respect and continued deliberation among people who feel conscience-bound by their understanding of Scripture. Comments about that? Reactions, thoughts? Especially from the people who are out of patience. What does that sound like to you? Jack has his hands in his he has his head in his hands.
Yeah. Spinach dish time.
I wonder if there's a certain kind of inevitability about both the eventual resolution of this in favor of accepting gay and lesbian people for ordination, and also the fact that it's going to cause a schism of some sort, that some people will leave.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure how the slowness of this process is going to affect that. If, because it has been a slow, inching forward process, there will be less, you know, less disruption, or whether it'll make a whole lot of difference. I do know that people are won over one at a time,
yeah,
one relationship at a time, you know, and so I don't know. But I still don't think it's okay to have it taking longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure for many of you this is horribly slow, but being from a conservative rural state, the whole societal functioning of our state is so much different than in many urban areas and in many other parts of the country. People have to remember that everything is further behind. It's not just the church.
Yeah.
You know, it's our society in those areas is further behind in feeling comfortable with a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we should go slow, but I'm just explaining, you know, what I see from where I'm from.
Tomorrow I'll talk about the four policy recommendations that the task force made in addition to preparing the social statement, which directly address the question of blessing same-sex unions and allowing people in such unions to be roster leaders, pastoral leaders in the ELCA. And those recommendations get at what they call structured flexibility that allows for the actual variation across the country in sort of where people are on this question. And it allows both for moving ahead where people are long past ready to move ahead, and already have, you know, that in many places they've long since lived into a new reality and are just waiting for the church to catch up. Other places they're not ready to go there yet. So it's an interesting, I think an interesting and pretty difficult effort to try and allow for us to be able to speak the truth about where we are. And it's one of the most honest social statements that we've done. I'm actually more happy with it than I thought I would be as it was in the process. And one of the reasons that I think it's honest is because it tries to find a way to be honest about where we are. And we're in some different places. And there's evidence of a lot of movement. I'm going to show tomorrow some recent research on the views of mainline clergy. And it's very interesting. Both age and proximity to relationships with gay and lesbian people are huge predictors of where people are on this question. The closer your relationship, there's a direct relationship between the closeness of your relationship to a gay lesbian person and your position on change in the church's policy, the church's teaching on this issue.
So you're saying that fear of things we just don't understand is a real issue with
it? I think that's really
that's
true.
Probably right.
I think that's really true, both those comments, but I also want to caution that creating progressive understanding of this is a higher evolution of thought. I think that that really creates an alienation of people that are in a different place.
I'm not sure higher or lower is as relevant as a nearness of relationship and a distance of relationship. And when the relationship is distant, it's easy for it to be an issue and not a and not a, and
yeah,
not a name.
I understand that. I think that it's possible to be in a relationship and disagree
it
as
is.
Well.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we need to hold up as
it does.
Actually a positive thing in the church is that you can disagree and still live together and be in the same body. It's tough. I mean, I'm in a more conservative area too. What I'm thinking about with this is that I'm afraid that it might give the perspective of a lukewarm church. You know, I think that's kind of in the back of our heads, is that we don't take a strong stand one way or the other. We're just kind of in the middle. But I think that's the reality, is that this is a very difficult discussion to have, and we do need the room for it. We haven't been very good at it. We've been conservatives talking together and more progressive people talking together. We haven't been good about creating that dialogue. And we can't just jump into it without being better about that, I think.
Their claim in this statement is that Lutherans are because of our teaching about grace, because of our teaching about our neediness before God, we're able to trust God, and that trust allows us to live with ambiguity, to live in unresolved, paradoxical, even tragic circumstances. So we ought to, I mean, part of what they're pushing the church to do is to say who we are theologically as a church ought to let us move ahead while being conflicted, not all agreeing. We need to stop, given the time, but my duty to the bookstore is they've been really kind and brought books of mine, so I want to just say what they are. This one is on sexuality, Married in the Sight of God, and I'm not doing anything related to it, but they have two others of my books, one on U2, One Step Closer, if you like rock music and want to see a theological take on their work, they have that. And Faith as a Way of Life is about connecting faith in everyday life, work, family, citizenship, and so forth. So those are in the bookstore if you're interested. And tomorrow afternoon, we're going to look at the policy recommendations on gay and lesbian folks and their relationships and their ministry in the church. So come back if you want to talk more about that. Thanks, everyone.